Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community. We'll be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is April 28th, 2011. Thank you to our many, many listeners for joining us, and we have been missing you during our vacation period. In addition, our first Thursday of each month, we will have our guest, constitutional lawyer, Greg Glazer, and you will be the first Thursday of each month. And I'm apologizing if our sound is not the best today. It seems that my headset is not working, and I hope it will get a little bit clearer. I also want to say that we're going to be listening in the next show to a brand new song that has been created by Alan about his freedom song. It is fabulous, and we will provide a link to the video, really fancy video that he created. For those people who are new to the show, there is a live chat, and I'm going to take a quick look to see if anyone is on the chat now. Of course, it's going to do that for me. It's going to make that sound. So we have two guests, and of course, whenever I try to sign in, it's going to do that for me. So pardon the technical difficulties today. It's been a while since I've logged on, and so I'm kind of recovering here to the system that we have. And they also created a brand new design. I just created a new instructional video for those who don't know how to sign on and listen. I really do appreciate your patience with me. So I'm going to introduce Alan. If you have not been listening, he is an attorney in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States all about vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice, and is published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters. He appears regularly at rallies, conferences, and on radio shows and TV. As a matter of fact, I believe that Alan has another show to be speaking on this afternoon. He is on a number of advisory boards and recently has become an author on Natural News with Mike Adams. So we're really, really pleased to have him. And he's going to start us off with some news today. Now, is he okay? Oh, I better make sure that he is logged on to the show. That is a true, you know, it's a little bit funny if you don't have a manager taking care of everything. One person working the switchboard and everything else. Okay, Alan, are you able to hear me now?
I can. And how are you doing today, Debbie?
Great. Okay, so I'm able to hear you too, and I've got the sound on, and hopefully everything will be great for the rest of the show now.
Terrific. Well, I got some real good news. I think this is probably what you were referring to. Just a few days ago, I had been working with a couple of different clients in the Navy over recent months and found some problems with the Navy regulations. And when I say problems, I mean instances where there appeared to be some either ambiguity or confusion in the regulations as it pertains to vaccine exemptions, and some instances where I felt that the Navy had overstepped its authority in terms of the level of restriction that the regulations were imposing upon Navy members and families with regard to immunizations. And so the good news is that in both instances, when I requested, I wrote to Navy officials in Washington, D.C., and requested changes and provided a legal analysis why I thought that the regulations as they existed currently were problematic constitutionally, that I got a favorable response both times, saying that, in effect, they agreed with me and they were changing regulations and policy accordingly. And I'll elaborate in a minute here, but I think this is particularly good news for me because, as you know, Debbie, I am a strong advocate of people having the right to make informed choices about vaccines or about anything that goes into their bodies. And oftentimes the best way to, I think that there's really sort of two fundamental aspects from my point of view to the whole vaccine controversy. And the first one is about being informed, being aware that there are serious problems and issues with vaccines and vaccine policy and law. And then the second part of it is, well, what do you do about that? And the answer to that, of course, is to become active in a way that helps to educate people, but also, and perhaps ultimately more importantly, to change the laws so that we have the right where we don't now to make informed choices, and to be watchful as well, because there are those who have an opposing agenda who would have restrict further than our right to make informed choices beyond where those rights may be now. So rights are seldom stagnant, and particularly in this area. And if we're not taking steps to expand our rights, others are taking steps to reduce or limit or restrict our rights. And so it's really not an issue where we can afford or have the luxury to sit on the fence and wait and see what happens. We really need to be active. And that means, for the most part, being legislatively active. But there really are only two or three ways that you can change laws. One is become legislatively active and have a state or federal legislature change or modify or enact new laws. The other is that sometimes you can do that through the courts to some extent, to a lesser extent generally, but courts have the authority to interpret current statutes and constitutional provisions and regulations, and sometimes that interpretation amounts to new law, at least in the sense of clarifying the application of current law to particular situations. Courts really always, to one extent or the other, a roll of the dice, though, so I don't recommend that generally as a way of trying to change the law. If you have a right that's being violated, court may very well be the proper place to go to get that dealt with, but as a way of changing laws generally in a broader sense, it's the vaccine rights arena has not been particularly successful in that regard in the courts. But this was such an interesting and unusual situation with the Navy, because in effect what we did was simply ask them to change the policy and regulations, and they said, okay. I mean, that's a gross generalization, but that's sort of the end result. Well, the truth of the matter is that lawmakers can and sometimes do enact laws that are unconstitutional. And the reason that they can do this is because technically a law isn't unconstitutional until a court says it is. And really, that's the way it should be, in my opinion, because anybody can at any time scream unconstitutional about any law. And for everybody who thinks a law is unconstitutional, there will almost invariably be somebody else who says, no, it's not, it is constitutional. So when we have those kind of disputes, to get a formal resolution, you ask a court. So the result then is that laws can be passed that are unconstitutional. that could happen because the person or people passing a law knew it was unconstitutional but just didn't care, or thought they'd see if they could get away with it, or something of that nature. But I'm sure it often happens inadvertently. I suspect that that's what happened with the Navy, that they were trying to do, according to current mainstream public policy, do the right thing and to have as few people objecting to vaccines or being unvaccinated as possible. And one way you do that is to put the tightest restrictions you can on exemptions. They just happen to have, in this instance, exceeded their authority. And fortunately, with making the proper legal arguments, they responded favorably without us having to become involved in a court proceeding or some other sort of grassroots legislative initiative or the like.
Can you give us a little bit more specifics of this particular instance? So you're talking about a naval in the Navy having mandatory vaccination. Is that what it's about?
Well, the military, military members are required to be vaccinated, but the military has medical and religious exemptions. And in fact, every federal context that would be include the military, immigration, U.S. territories that are not states, those are all federal jurisdictions. And all the federal jurisdictions, to the best of my knowledge, have medical and religious exemptions to immunizations. And another reason why we may have pulled this off in this way with the Navy is because we're dealing with an agency here, a federal agency, and they had clearly the flexibility to respond in the way that they did. They had ultimately, I don't think, any obligation to respond in the way that they did, but I think they certainly had the authority to do that. And glad for all concerned, of course, that they did. Well, there were really two different instances, and the first one was somewhat very narrow in its focus. And so I didn't make a big deal out of the first time, although, of course, I was delighted for the outcome. And the second time was much broader. But let me talk the first one.
You're saying there were occurrences where something happened, two instances where something happened, and somebody took action legislatively?
Well, no, and this is the whole point. And let me just explain then in a little more detail. There were, the bottom line is there were two instances where problems came up. People contacted me and then became clients of mine, where there were problems with them wanting to exercise a religious exemption and the Navy telling them, no, you can't do this. And the reason the Navy was saying no is because the regulations said no. And, of course, in the military, you got to go by the book, even more so than in other situations. And so even if there was a problem with the regulations, the answer could very well be, well, you know, sorry, sir, or sorry, ma'am, but this is what the regulations say. You know, if you want to go talk to someone else and get them changed, fine, but we have to go by the regulations.
Right. And you say they can't waiver. And they can't go case by case. They only have what is their statute on their books, and they go by that. It's sort of like they don't really think. They just do.
Well, I mean, and to some extent, that's what's – unless there were authority within the regulations themselves saying, you know, go case by case, and here's the amount of discretion you have or what have you. But that sort of discretion was not built into the regulations. And so when you say, I want to do A, and they say the regulations say B, you're stuck, generally speaking.
Okay, so you were advising this family.
So let me give you the first instance, the narrow one, and then the larger one, well, I think, was the second one. But the first one involved a naval family. The Navy member, the member and family were in Italy. They were transferring to Spain. It was a foreign country to foreign country transfer. And the family was opposed to immunizations, and there was no problem with them refusing immunizations in Italy, and there was no problem with them refusing immunizations in Spain. But according to the regulations, they had to be immunized to do the transfer. which on its face seems kind of silly when I, you know, when I explain it that way. But again, if that's what the regulations say, that's what they, the Navy folks have to go by. Well, there were problems for that, from my point of view, analytically, beyond the obvious inconsistency that I just that was apparent in the way I just described the situation. We have in federal law here in the United States, law it's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that requires government, if it's going to burden the exercise of religion, to do that only if there's a compelling government interest, and I think we could all agree that it, in today's mainstream view, vaccination would be considered to be a compelling government interest. But they also have to do it in the least restrictive means. Well, clearly the least restrictive means would allow for this family to refuse vaccines for religious reasons. As I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, every federal jurisdiction provides and offers and allows religious exemptions. And furthermore, international travel generally is falls under the World Health Organization, the international health regulations. And even the World Health Organization only requires yellow fever vaccine for international travel and only for going in and out of certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa and tropical South America, where yellow fever is a persistent problem. So when the international authorities and federal law provide strong arguments that the family shouldn't be required to be immunized, and when at the direction of my clients, I took this to naval authorities in Washington, D.C., Now, the people that the clients were dealing with directly didn't have authority to change policy or change regulations, but we went up to the top where they do have authority to change policy and change regulations. And I'm, again, very happy to report that I got a response from the folks in Washington, and they said, yes, we agree with your analysis. And I gave you a quick summary. It was a three-page legal analysis. But those were the basic concepts, talking about problems there and then the inconsistency within the regulations themselves. And the response was, in effect, yes, you're right. We'll get that fixed and taken care of. And meanwhile, if the family's having a problem, have them call me, you know, someone in Washington who does have the authority to tell the people involved, the officials involved, hey, these folks can transfer without getting the immunizations. But the second instance that happened with a client this past winter was a much broader matter. He brought to my attention that there are Navy regulations that require someone applying for a religious exemption to be a member of an organized religion with a tenet or a belief opposing immunizations, and to have what they refer to as an authorized personal religious counselor effectively endorse the Navy member's exemption request. And it was sort of interesting that this hadn't come to my attention before it did, but the reason that that occurred is that there are regulations that are what are sometimes referred to as multi-branch regulations. That is, they're documents that apply to multiple branches of the military that set out the procedure for religious exemption. And those regulations don't say anything about being a member of an organized religion. And the reason that they don't is probably because there's a line of federal legal precedent addressing First Amendment boundaries. The First Amendment has the so-called free exercise clause, referring to the free exercise of religion. Our rights are not unbounded. You know, we can't all sacrifice a goat every Saturday night in the name of religion or do just anything we want to in the name of religion, but it's a very powerful and far-reaching right. And so when federal courts have looked at vaccine exemptions and said, what are the First Amendment boundaries, there's a line of precedent that tells us that it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion. It doesn't even matter which religion you belong to if you do belong to an organized religion. What matters is, do you have a belief that is religious in nature and that is sincerely held? And if you meet those two requirements, and of course implied in there is that the beliefs are opposed to immunizations, then you qualify for religious exemption if you're in a situation where they're offering a religious exemption. Whether or not state and federal governments have to offer a religious exemption is a separate question, but once they do, First Amendment rights attached to that. And so the Navy was going way beyond, bottom line, its authority, in my opinion, because there's legal precedent arguing that, no, you don't have to be a member of an organized religion. And, again, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that says government has to do this, achieve their so-called compelling government interest in the least restrictive manner. And we know from the herd immunity theory, which is probably the reason we have religious and philosophical exemptions anywhere that they exist today, is because the herd immunity theory tells us that not everybody has to be immunized for everybody to be protected. So we as a society, under mainstream views on vaccination, can tolerate a small percentage of people refusing vaccines for religious or in some instances when they're available, philosophical reasons, because we still have most people vaccinated, and that still provides the desired end result, again, based on the herd immunity theory. So the least restrictive manner does not require that everybody absolutely be immunized. So again, I wrote back, I now had a specific name contact person with the Navy after having written to some folks at the top of the ladder who predictably and appropriately deferred to a person whose job would be to deal with this issue specifically. And again, you know, raised questions in a legal analysis and ultimately got a response back saying that they were going to be, they had already changed policy.
Did you just write a letter?
I did this with a letter.
Okay.
A letter where I wrote a legal analysis, 2-3 page analysis, citing the problematic regulations and citing and arguing an application of relevant federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and federal legal precedent that were contrary to the Navy's own regulations. See, there's these multi-branch regulations that say how to do a religious exemption, but apparently some of the individual branches have added their own additional requirements to the multi-branch document. And that was the part with regard to the Navy that I was not aware of specifically until I had a client call that to my attention. But upon seeing that and realizing that it was contrary to federal law and federal legal precedent, I then wrote a letter to the Navy with that analysis and assessment. And again, was just delighted to see that they responded by saying, in effect, hey, you're right, we'll take care of that. So the last information I got just a few days ago was that they have already changed policy and that they're taking steps, and you know, bureaucracies anywhere and everywhere, in and out of government. It'll take them a few months to get the regulations updated. I would imagine that this has possibly raised a question with Navy policy beyond merely vaccine religious exemptions. They have to deal with people of many different religions, and that raises potential concerns and problems or issues with vaccine religious exemptions, but many other religious issues as well. So I would imagine that this may have prompted what could be a more comprehensive review of the Navy's policy with regard to religious matters generally. But in any event, and I hope so, if there are any other places where they have, and again, I'm sure it's inadvertent on their part, but regardless, you know, there could be any number of places. If they had an issue with it here, there may be other areas where they need to look at their policy regarding religion as well. But in any event, the word is that they have already changed policy and that they're in process now of changing, getting the regulations themselves updated accordingly. So,
Alan, do you, one of the things that strikes me here in this particular situation is that you did not have to go to court. You did not have to make a case out of changing this policy. They acted on their own. And I'm thinking one of the reasons that they went ahead and made this very swift correction is because that they look upon you as an authority figure in the legal world, in the constitutional world, and the vaccination arena. where you have been quite active, vocal, and now with Natural News, which makes headlines, and they, when people write there and have millions of people tweeting. So I think, you know, the fact that your name is now quite well known and this is your specialty, that the policy has been taken a closer look at and made a quick correction.
Well, I have no idea if they did any looking behind my letter to see who I am or what I do. I like to think that they considered my actual legal arguments. And it's not just a question of, oh, let's be nice and cooperate from their point of view, even though there is certainly an element of that in their response. But I think from their point of view, by taking an honest look at the analysis, and this was not really a close call in my opinion. It was just a matter that whoever had put in those regulations, for whatever reason, you know, probably was not aware of the information that I was aware of. If I had been the one asked to design the regulations, of course, they wouldn't have had those restrictions. But we can't expect everybody to know everything about everything, you know. So I'm not being critical of the Navy. They aren't the first or only ones to ever, you know, try to require people to be a member of an organized religion. It used to be common throughout the states. It still is in some state laws. Those laws where it still exists.
It's heartening to hear that your letter arrived on someone's desk who actually read it and took it, you know, seriously and didn't just brush it off, because, you know, how many letters are probably sent to these people and they can, you know, get lost in the day-to-day affairs. So,
well, let me give you a couple examples, and you're absolutely right, Debbie. That is was most heartening. I back during the pandemic, I wrote to 5 different North Carolina state officials, including the governor, state representatives, head of the Department of Education, I think, and some other folks. 3 of them. Let me see. I think maybe I got a response from 3 of the 5. And one of the responses was a real nice note saying, I'm looking into this. And the other 2 were generic responses that made it clear that they had not seen and responded to any of the issues I raised in my letter. So
exactly.
I conclude.
So what I'm saying is, instead of getting a form letter back, you know, just brushing you off, that somebody had actually taken the time to go through and read your letter. How long did you say it was? 6 pages?
Well, I did this 2 different times, and I don't remember exactly, probably about 3 pages, you know, to make the full legal argument. But you're absolutely right, you know, that someone there did take the time to consider seriously what I had said. Now, I've had a different experience in North Carolina once where there was a piece of legislation going through that in concept I endorsed, but the particular version I thought was problematic. So I actually was not able to go to Raleigh, our capital here in North Carolina, when there was the opportunity for citizens to go and voice their concerns, but I sent a letter. And that letter, it turns out, derailed the proposed legislation. And I actually had a state senator, the one who had sponsored the legislation, call me and make an appointment to come see me and say, what do we need to do to get you on board with this? So you never know what one person may be able to do. Now, I had a real interesting experience with Washington State that sort of fell in between those 2 North Carolina examples. As I think you know, Debbie, the Washington State, actually both chambers have just recently passed legislation that would place unconstitutional restrictions on religious exemptions there in Washington. And I wrote a letter with a constitutional analysis, and folks in Washington took this to a representative of the governor, along with other things that they shared in a meeting. And the representative came back with something very similar to what I was discussing just a little bit ago here in today's show. And the representative says, in effect, something like, well, with regard to me, here's the legal argument saying why this law that you've just you've just passed. Now, the governor hasn't signed it into law yet, so the people are meeting with a representative from the governor in the hopes that they can convince the governor ultimately not to sign this legislation, because it is pretty clearly and obviously, in my opinion, when you look at the legal analysis, it's unconstitutional. And or on a more practical level, it would be subject to challenge for lack of constitutionality if it is enacted into law. And if done so formally in court, the likely outcome is the law is going to be stricken or amended or something changed. And so the representative for the governor says, quite accurately, well, you know, okay, so you have this argument that's unconstitutional, but we can pass this anyway. You know, we don't get to say whether it's unconstitutional or not. That's up to the courts. But I am happy to report that the person who was presenting this argument came back with a beautiful response to that, because that's absolutely correct. As I said earlier in the show, legislature can pass any law they want to, whether somebody thinks it's unconstitutional or not. But the response to that was, well, okay, but if it gets challenged and it is stricken ruled to be unconstitutional, you folks are going to have egg on your face. You know, it's going to come out that people in the Washington legislature and the governor are passing unconstitutional laws. And that did cause cause the person to pause a little bit and say, okay, maybe I should show this to the governor. So you know, there's never a guarantee what people are going to do with the arguments. But one of the main takeaways here, Debbie, I think, with this whole discussion is that a couple of them. The first one is that just to say something is unconstitutional is pointless, really. But if you've got a legal argument, if you can say here's why it's unconstitutional, it violates this law or it's inconsistent with this legal precedent, if you can make a sound legal argument, then you have some weight behind your cry of unconstitutional. So that's one of the takeaways. One of the other takeaways is you never know what you know one individual can do. Yes, when you're dealing with any sort of legislative matter, it's generally best to have as many people as you can on the phones or emailing the representative saying they're for or against the legislation, you know, whatever's appropriate in the particular instance. Numbers matter in legislative issues, but they are not that's not the only way to get things done. And again,
I wanted to give you an example. I received a phone call yesterday from an organization that asked, it's sort of like a three-way party line. They connect you directly with your representative's office. And this has happened to me numerous times in the past couple of years, where there's going to be some sort of a congressional action. Usually it has to do with finances and where money is being allocated or whether something is going to be changed. And there is someone who is passionate about the issue who calls people in the voting region. So like for me, it was someone in North Carolina was going to make a vote on an issue, and they connect you directly with that representative's office so that you can speak and leave your comment, whether it is to please vote against this issue or please vote for this issue. And I think that really heightens the amount of actual action, and they tally this up, the offices, the senators or representatives, they tally up how many people are pro or con a particular issue.
And I think that's an appropriate, as a general rule, an appropriate way for representatives to vote is to say, well, what do my constituents want? And, of course, they're not limited to approaching every matter in that sort of more idealistic democratic way. But one of the things that's fascinating to me about the constitutionality approach to challenge something on its constitutionality is that if you make a clear and convincing argument and someone on the other end actually hears that it only takes one person to make that argument for the people on the other side to say, oh, we really shouldn't do this. Now, it turns out that even with an argument of unconstitutional, and even if it's a good argument, that a legislature can still do whatever they want. And this is what was so wonderful about the Navy is they didn't take the so sue me kind
right.
of attitude that I see in other contexts. You know, I see that with clients, for example. I write legal opinion letters. I've seen this most particularly with healthcare. Employers will make the legal argument, here's the federal law, here's the law that requires you, here's the government's position on this, and all in favor of the client. And most of the time, that works. But every once in a while, the hospital employing the healthcare person says, in effect, so sue me. And with
right,
healthcare
because
employees...
Either they think that they can win. Obviously, they didn't think that they could win with your strong argument.
Well, here's why in that particular arena they can do that and get away with it. Because most healthcare employers are what are called at-will employees. Most employees are what are called at-will employees. And that means that the employer ultimately can fire them at any time for any reason. And so if you're in that kind of situation, okay, so they fire you for the wrong reason because you didn't get vaccinated against your religious beliefs, and you take them to court and you win, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, they fire you for no reason, which they can do. And so having the law in your favor does not always mean that as a practical matter, it makes sense to go sue for your rights. And that's, you know, deeply distressing to me, frankly, personally and professionally. But that's the reality we live with. So this is what yet another reason why I keep coming back to this same mantra over and over again, that we need to be looking for legislative solutions to the problems of vaccine exemption and waiver rights and the limitations to our ability to make informed choices.
I like the mantra, to find legislative solutions. And this means, obviously, that the populace must take some action to uphold the Constitution or to make their will heard of what they really want to do in terms of freedoms. So we also have some commentary. I don't know whether you've been able to be on the chat today. It's a little bit off topic, but Dr. Bob has spoken about this new chickenpox live vaccine plant in Clayton, North Carolina, that's going to employ 350 people. He says that the vaccine is 70% effective. However, between 1-2% of those vaccinated will develop a usually mild case of shingles, herpes zoster. So that means that they will have that in their body for the rest of their life. That could break out into, I've heard, quite horrible symptoms.
North Carolina, not that we're alone in the country on this by any means, but North Carolina is becoming a hotspot now on this issue. Just today, I was reading an article about the expansion of a plant in Durham to make live virus vaccines. And, of course, you may recall we talked about recently a new plant subsidized to the tune of a few hundred million dollars by the federal government in Holly Springs,
yeah.
North Carolina,
exactly.
For making pandemic viral vaccines. And North Carolina's biotech industry has referred to North Carolina as Vaccine Central. Four of the five largest vaccine manufacturers have set up shop here. And I just also read an article, or saw an article, I haven't even had time to read the whole article, out in Asheville, Western North Carolina, has the highest exemption rate in the state, and officials are now getting nervous about that. I mean, they've been nervous about it, but they're now taking action to investigate and figure out what's going on. And this was inevitable because, again, you know, folks who are operating under this, frankly, already disproven but nonetheless still upheld herd immunity theory, it's okay if a small percentage of people don't vaccinate, but at some point, and immunization rates generally have been increasing in the last decade or more around the country. And overall rates range from probably 1-3%, but there are pockets, individual schools or areas where their exemption rate is as high as 15-20%, according to some sources. And so inevitably, as exemption rates rise in any given area, they're going to reach a point where authorities are going to say, well, wait a second now, this is reaching the point where it's going to be past whatever they consider the herd immunity threshold to be. It's going to cause public, it's going to create a some sort of public health emergency, and then they want to try to step in and say, okay, you know, no more exemptions in one form or another. So it's sort of the inevitable clash that's going to happen everywhere as exemption rates continue to rise. But it's my hope that as government officials see these problems, the rates rising high enough to be what they consider to be a problem, where some sort of formal step has to be taken to limit exemptions, potentially even introducing legislation to remove the option altogether, for example, that at the same time, that will be there will be enough people who are concerned about that who will say, no, what needs to go away here is not the exemption, but the mandate, the vaccine mandate. So things are going to get more difficult before they get easier on this issue, I think.
Right. And, you know, I'm wondering, it seems an interesting phenomena that North Carolina is producing these live vaccines and is going, as you say, it's called Vaccine Central. But Dr. Bob is on the line, and he can tell you that the poultry industry must be number one. I'm going to ask him to give some little data in the chat room, but we produce the most number of turkeys and chickens probably in the country or somewhere thereabouts. And it's interesting that vaccinations are produced using chickens, right? So it's to be a confluence combination of those two things coming together in this area. And when you mentioned Asheville, Asheville is sort of like a hippie place in North Carolina. Many people might not have known that. So Dr. Bob says that, yes, we are number one in chickens and turkeys, and we are the second number two producer in pigs. So there you have swine flu. So we've got all of those three animals right here as hot spots, and we are using them to make our vaccinations. It's quite an interesting phenomena that I'm seeing here.
Well, it's interesting to me if does Dr. Bob want to comment? Is he on the line?
I don't know if he's called in. I can check.
Oh, okay.
No, he hasn't called in, but he's on the chat room if there's any comments he wants to make here. He's welcome to call in also. But he said that chicken eggs are used to make the vaccines, and we know that there are
right.
a lot of children today who are highly allergic to chickens, chicken products, chicken eggs, and, of course, milk, dairy products, wheat, and things like that. But eggs are high on the list for allergic reactions, and here we are putting them into children this way.
Well, let me respond, if I may, Debbie, with we have discussed on this show in the past a document that I prepared at the request of some folks in New Hampshire to share with the New Hampshire legislature, arguments supporting their bill for philosophical exemption there, and how when I sat down to pull together the information that I had and to make the arguments I wanted to make, that I felt that not only is a philosophical exemption justified, but there's actually a moral and ethical imperative in large part, for example, because the pharmaceutical industry regularly and routinely engages in criminal behavior, and nobody should ever be mandated to get a product from an industry that has that kind of a immoral track record. But a new piece of information just came to my attention that I want to use as kind of a response to that whole vaccine thing. Because what's important, I think, for those of us who have done some of our own research and have concerns, the issue is so vast, and at times it's really hard to boil it down for at least introduction purposes to a few concise facts and points. Well, here's another one that I've added to that document now. I've updated it. According to the CIA World Factbook, the U.S. is 46th in infant mortality in the world, and this was 2009 data. And yet we have by far the highest vaccination rate. Now, I looked at a study that looked at 30 developed countries, and we have, according to this article, we required 36 vaccines of children, and the average of the 30 countries looked at was 18. So we have twice the average requirement. But in just kind of plain English and simple terms, and I really think this is a really difficult argument to refute, frankly, although I'd love for someone to play devil's advocate and tell us what we can expect to hear as we put this out more. But we are, what, the world's leading superpower. We are considered to have some of, if not the best medical technology in the world. We're certainly not a third world country. How is it, if vaccines are so great, how is it that the country that has the most vaccines and all these other credits medically and medical technologically, that we are 46th in infant mortality? I mean, those are just so blatantly inconsistent. And we also, by the way, of the 30 countries looked at, the U.S. has the highest under 5 mortality rate of these 30 Western countries. And so it's just, you know, there's just so many pieces of information, and this is only one of them, but there's so many pieces of information that when you look at it that just don't make sense. If vaccines are so great and wonderful and everybody needs them, if we have twice as many vaccines as the other Western countries, you know, we ought to have half the infant mortality rate or the under 5 mortality rate. Are we doing something terribly wrong here? Do we kill more children in car wrecks or lightning strikes, or what else is it? That, you know, if vaccines are so good, what is it that we're doing that's so bad with our medicine and medical technology and child care and child protection that we're 46th? So
Alan.
Yes.
Alan, this is Bob. How are you doing?
Good, Bob.
We
good.
Should maybe introduce you, Dr. Bob.
Yes,
Dr. Bob is a plant pathologist, environmentalist, global climate expert, and forestry expert at North Carolina State University, and he is on the line with us with the commentary.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what Alan said. I was just teaching a lecture about this not 2 weeks ago about the fact that the United States spends more per capita by almost a factor of 70% than any other country in the world for quote-unquote medical care. On the other hand, when it comes to both infant mortality and child mortality, as you said, we are behaving more like a third world country. There are places in Central and Eastern Europe, certainly a lot of places in South America, that have better statistics than we do. The reality is that we love to claim about our high technology and all of our trying to fix, that's the key word, people who are diseased. But when it comes to disease prevention and being able to actually grow healthy people, we, again, are behaving like a third world country. On top of that, one of the secrets that exists out there in the medical community, which is sad, and I'm not sure for the exact reasons for it, is that when you do get sick, which is when you will get attention in this country, you go into the hospital, and your chances of coming out of that hospital alive are incredibly lower than, again, in countries like Costa Rica and major cities in India and Thailand because of iatrogenic disease, infection, all kinds of things that go on within our system. So we claim to be very high tech, and I think the vaccinations are part of that high-tech scenario. That, you know, what is it, before the age of 3, a child gets 60-some-odd vaccinations in terms of the individual antigens that are put into the child. So, therefore, this is good. Yet, as you pointed out, absolutely correctly so. I mean, 100% to you is that the statistics do not back up at all the fact that we are a healthier nation. And that, of course, is a trillion-dollar question, not billion-dollar question, is where is all this money going, and why are the results so poor?
So we're making many claims and putting out this propaganda, in other words, that a statement that is not backed up at all. And we have some other comments from Victor in the chat room who does tell us a little bit more information about what happens when these chickens are manipulated and then put into the body or eaten. He said that a homeopathic friend told him he had a patient with a problem and that the patient's breast began to grow and look like a woman's breast, and he didn't know what to do until he met the homeopath and went for routine care. But I tried to explain that there are hormones that are being put into the chickens in order for them to grow plumper, bigger, faster, and besides the fact that there are phytoestrogens in the environment. And also, Victor tells us in this scenario, the patient loved to eat chicken meat, and that the chickens in the country were being vaccinated with growth hormones that were produced from human female growth hormones. And that means those are being taken in by the human body, whoever eats them. And then we know also that chickens are fed lots of hormones and antibiotics, and that now in the United States, because of the recent salmonella outbreaks, they were making laws to require chickens to be vaccinated against salmonella. So we have so many complex issues dealing with what is happening with chickens. Production of chickens is vile, the way that they are treated, and this is affecting people when they eat these chickens. It's just a lot of things happening all at once, and we have a lot of people who are looking at vegetarians are looking at human rights people concerned about their health, people concerned about animal rights. There are a lot of people who are going to be getting together on these issues to make some legislative changes, and that's what Alan is waiting for the people to do.
Well, you're bringing up the fact that basically environmental hormones is one of the best-kept secrets in this country. All plastic bottles that contain BPA were banned in Canada, the UK, and Australia. Basically, every human being in this country, by the time they are 5 years old, are saturated with bisphenol A, which is a estrogenic mimicking hormone. Sperm counts have gone down 70% in the United States. The incidence of breast cancer and other problems keep going up. The government likes to keep secrets to us when it involves environmental things, because in the case of plastics that are in our food, that we use in manufacturing for our food, is a $17 billion a year industry. They have more lobbyists than I have professors at my university. And money talks, nobody walks. But the people are the ones that are being duped, trying to get the truth when it comes to environmental problems in our country, is usually answered by the recent 20% decrease in the budget of the U.S. EPA, because after all, we can't have environmental laws because it's bad for the economy. So sorry if I'm acting cynical, but the things that we're talking about with vaccinations can be seen over and over and over again when it comes to all human and ecological environmental issues in this country.
And boy, very well said, by the way, Bob, and really appreciate your contribution on all of that. I'd love to have more information and more details on all of the above in the future. Please, please continue to come back as a guest on the show.
Sure.
Alan, we have about 4 minutes. Did you want to tell us on to any other news relating to the ANH?
ANH.
Yes. Is that what we were just talking about? Let's see. That was the major lawsuit on qualified health claims.
I'm sorry. I don't know what you're referring to.
Okay.
I was just going to comment that as a quick follow-up to Bob, that it seems clear enough that policy is driven by money, and that people can either, in attempting to influence policy for financial reasons, people can either do so with complete disregard or complete ignorance of the adverse effects of that on individual human beings. And those are fundamental problems that need to be changed in a redesign of our society.
Well, regarding
and,
the estrogenic hormones, Alan, basically you are talking about one of the largest chemical manufacturing lobbies in this country. The data is there. Literally 10 miles from where you work at the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, they've been studying estrogenic hormones since 1977. Over 5,000 papers have been published showing human effects in particular, and they are ignored, disregarded, and frankly, the people that are selling this stuff are nothing short of being whores regarding the fact. It is not ignorance any longer. 20 years ago, it was ignorance. Today, it is absolute incompetence and disregard for human health in the sake of profits. Again, one of the highest profit margin businesses in the United States. You buy a bottle of Coca-Cola, the total ingredients, including the packaging, is worth about 1.3% super wholesale, and they're selling it to you in the store for $1.75. Not a bad way to make money.
Okay, well, I did want to mention this just even though we don't have a lot of information. It's the ANH and the USA Wins major lawsuit on qualified health claims. Just because, Alan, you did an incredible job, one person making a difference to the lawyer to let people know, let the legislators know that something was unconstitutional. On April 13th, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia held that the FDA's denial of two health claims, which dealt with the ability of antioxidant vitamins to reduce the risk of cancer, was unconstitutional under the First Amendment. So I think this is saying that vitamin manufacturers will be able to make claims, and unless I am reading it incorrectly. The ANH USA, together with Dirk Persson and Sandy Shaw, sued the FDA for censoring antioxidant vitamin cancer risk reduction claims.
Let me just clarify real quick that the First Amendment has different clauses, and this is referring to free speech, as opposed to, I often refer to First Amendment with regard to the free exercise of religion, but those are both elements of the First Amendment. And specifically what the win means is that selenium supplements are now allowed to claim that selenium may reduce the risk of certain cancers, prostate, colon, bladder, or thyroid cancer. And so I certainly hope that that will have implications for supplements generally. And it very well may.
Because they've been hammering down on nutritional supplements and vitamin manufacturers that they can't make any claims when the data is actually in. And, you know, so we need to have this ability to get the information freely and that, you know, to say that grapes are good for you and why they are good for you and things like that.
The only reason not to be able to make a claim, any claim that has science supporting it, or even a qualified claim, perhaps, if it doesn't have peer-reviewed studies supporting it, is to limit competition in the marketplace, you know, for somebody who wants to not let that information get out because they have a contrary financial goal. And that's the sort of thing that goes on routinely, as I think Dr. Bob is underscoring so eloquently. That's routine. That's what happens in this country and in the world today. And it is so fundamentally unethical and immoral for that to be the case. We need a redesign of the system.
Okay. What? We have finished. I hate to cut you short, but we have actually finished the show today, and we'll pick up next Thursday with Greg Glazer on constitutional law and with Alan. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Our George.